Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, marking 47 years of commitment to operating the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Alaska nonprofits are often at the center of supporting a wide range of services, people, and supplies throughout Alaskan communities. Job training, scholarships, supplemental food, medical care, education support, disaster relief, and grants for community infrastructure ripple out from large and small nonprofit organizations across the state. New guidelines to access federal grants could open the door for increased funding to our state. We'll discuss the current business climate and what's on the horizon for Alaska's nonprofits today on Talk of Alaska. Hello, from Alaska Public Media, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Hundreds of nonprofit organizations help address large and small needs for communities in even the most remote parts of Alaska. The ability for these funding organizations to tailor their support to Alaskans' needs means their work can be highly effective and aimed at specific priorities. As the work of nonprofits has grown, the guidance for requirements, especially for federal funds, has at times been a barrier. The paperwork too daunting for small groups that are trying to help their communities, or the specific requirements too cumbersome or not aligned with the unique needs that different regions have. But change is happening, and today we have three nonprofit experts in the studio to discuss the current landscape for Alaska's nonprofit sector and what could be opening up in light of changes to federal funding rules. Joining me today are three powerhouse leaders: Lori Wolf, the president and CEO of the 4-Acre Group, Gretchen Guess, the president and CEO of the Rasmussen Foundation, and Alex McKay, president and CEO of the Alaska Community Foundation. Thank you all for being here. It's quite a vibe to have three presidents in the studio with me. So, Lori, I want to start with you. You've been with 4-Acre for 24 years and the CEO since 2015. Give us a brief snapshot of the services the 4-Acre Group provides and how the organization has grown through those decades.
Wow. Okay. 2 seconds or less. thanks for asking. So 4-Acre serves nonprofits and tribes across the state of Alaska. We do that with real two hats on. We're a nonprofit capacity builder. So I like to say we strengthen organizations from the inside out. That's working with boards, staff, and volunteers on topics that are most pressing to them to get their missions done. So it looks like good governance and fundraising and really all the things that help them run their good businesses. And then on the flip side, we're also the state nonprofit the state nonprofit association. So we do research on the sector, and we take on big public policy, nonpartisan public policy issues that impact the nonprofit sector. And that work has mostly evolved to meet the needs of the sector by really just good listening. And the convening role has changed over the years. We've always been a convener, but we're convening around more complex ideas than before, perhaps. But, you know, the work is fundamental, and we see ourselves as part of the building blocks of the work that happens every day.
Talk a little more about the capacity building aspect of, as you mentioned, strengthening from the inside out.
So we started out doing shared services, which is really back office services. We learned that from the North Slope in the early days. So that idea that you can consolidate the backside of the house so that nonprofits can do what they do best on the front side. So, for example, we do payroll and accounting for over 100 nonprofits and tribes across the state. That's about 1,000 people's payroll every 2 weeks, right? So we're that. So it's kind of a backbone service. It's invisible. If you went into that nonprofit and tried to see how they do the work, you wouldn't see us, but we're doing the work. So there's a number of backbone services that we provide, or what we call shared services. And then there's more facilitation, what most people would call consulting. It's that facilitation, holding space, convening, those areas. That's mostly working with boards and leadership staff. And then there's leadership development work that we do, and then a whole range of educational opportunities, everything from cohort-based convenings where we bring people in for multiple months where they get peer support, and then take a class online and have a 2-hour experience. And so The idea in every single aspect of 4-Acre is all about support. So no matter how you engage with us, you're going to get the support either through peer support or our support or connections across the state. That's our goal.
So if someone in a community right now is thinking, we need a nonprofit here to do X, Y in our community, should they start with you?
They can start with us. We have a really fun tool on our website called So You Want to Start a Nonprofit. And we encourage everyone, it says, and read this first. And so we do encourage people to read that first. And then we offer a free class once a quarter for people who are interested in starting new nonprofits. Or we also have a class called So You Started One, Now What? Because lots of people, like, they have an idea, but then it doesn't really kind of get the momentum that it needs. And so then there's the conversation about kind of what to do. But we always say to people, you know, look around first. Look at what's happening in your community. Look at what's happening in your region. Understand the state as a whole. We have a lot of organizations doing remarkable work across the state. So before you start your own thing, we'd like you to kind of know what's already out there and see if you can just contribute time, money, energy to the things that already exist before you go out and do your own thing. There is a time and a place for a new thing. But it's not always the first choice.
Sure. Yeah, that makes good sense. Thanks for getting us started here. Alex, I want to turn to you now. The Alaska Community Foundation is sort of an umbrella organization for dozens of individual nonprofit funds. Is that a correct way to characterize it?
Yes. Yeah, we have probably 12 to 13 different types of funds. And then within, when you total them up, we have probably just under 3,000 funds.
Talk about the various types of funds and how people can find out how to contribute to specific types of the nonprofits that are under your larger organization.
We have so many categories of funds, but I think the largest one that a lot of people know about are donor-advised funds. And those are where donors have designated their donation to benefit one or more organizations, causes, or communities. We also under that, we actually manage the Hillcorp Employee Donor Advised Funds. So, and they really make their choices about where the funds go. That's about 25% of what we do. We also have agency funds, and those are for organizations, kind of a back-end service like Lori was talking about. If we manage their money. So there's money that they've set aside for now, and then they can request it, and it's sort of granted to them. Once the money comes to the Alaska Community Foundation, it's really Alaska Community Foundation's money, but then we have advisors, and then they can make recommendations for how the money is distributed. So probably a quarter of our funds are agency funds, and those are all over the state. We have funds, field of interest funds, which are interesting, and they usually have grant cycles associated with them, like the Social Justice Fund. Mm-hmm. That's one that people would know about. There are also other types of funds. There's a CAMPS initiative funded by the Rasmussen Foundation, and those are advertised. And actually, all of these, you can go onto our website and look under grants and funds and have a description of what there is and what funding opportunities there are. They won't see opportunities necessarily for the donor-advised funds. Those are really generated by recommendations from the donors. And then we have special project funds, and those are pretty exciting. Those are really a unique thing that we can do. We really pool money. And that's been done in different ways. We have, during the COVID crisis, there was a CARES Act ARPA funds. There was a lot of advocacy from Rasmussen, from 4-Acre Group, to make sure that there was some of this money was set aside for nonprofits. So $50 million was set aside, and then the Alaska Community Foundation actually administered that and had different funders kind of making the decision so the money could get out quickly. So that's something we can do. And so we accept funds in a way that, for example, 4-Acre, I mean, Rasmussen does not accept funds. It's just not part of their business design. We had another project during COVID called PPE Project, and now everyone knows what that is. Didn't know it before. And that was really, there were community members saying we can't get PPE, only hospitals can and nursing homes. And so this was an effort to pool money from multiple funders and actually buy the PPE, worked with community members, had that distributed across the state, and really got that out. So that was a very unique, special.
And important.
Yeah, that was very important. And then we have other ones like the Alaska Leaders Archive is a project that's going on right now with kind of led by the Ted Stevens Foundation. Mm-hmm. And then that was one of the funds at Alaska Community Foundation. There was an earmark that Senator Murkowski arranged for. And so we managed that, kind of managed the federal grant, which can be complicated. But it's a way of managing things, pooling the money, getting, we can actually work with other donors, and they have a place to put the money. It could be individuals or other foundations. So that's a service we offer.
Yeah, and we'll drill down a little bit on some of those individual funds and what's meant by their different names. But you're not in the president CEO chair deciding you get grant funds, you do not. So talk about how individual grant awards, the system that's in place to make those funding decisions.
Right, and that's actually something that's sort of, it's very challenging, but it's actually something I really love about the Community Foundation, because we're really accountable to the community. And so we have probably, you know, over 300 volunteers, whether it's on our board or investment committee. We have individual cycles. Some of these donor-advised funds have cycles, and they have advisors that have been recommended, and then we approve those. And they make those grant decisions. So we don't make the grant decisions. And that's kind of, in a way, the beauty of it. I think that sort of seems fun to actually make the decisions. But when you've done it for a long time, you start to realize it's actually the community members that really know what needs to happen, you know, and who are closer to the issue. One of the challenges of being a statewide organization is we're here. And then we have this vast geography. And it's really about local input and local knowledge. And so the more we can, and we're really focusing on that, really being statewide and engaging local people, getting them on kind of the grant cycles. We have, I can't even remember how many different grant cycles that happened during the year. For example, on scholarships, we have 52 different scholarships, and each one of those has their own advisory group. And so really trying to deepen that, and then also deepen through partnerships.
You know, I feel that I should disclose, too, mm-hmm. in the interest of transparency, that I chair one of the advisory, a small advisory board that has a fund housed at the Alaska Community Foundation. Mm-hmm. So just letting folks know that. Gretchen, thank you so much for your patience here. When you took the helm of the Rasmussen Foundation, you took some time to sort of assess everything after, you know, a long tenure of the previous leader. So grants weren't going out for a period of time. What was the work taking place, and did you sort of redesign how grants are made or what the focus is?
Thank you for that question. Yes, last year we went on a pause for some, actually not all of our grant making, but the grant making that really impacts a lot of people. And during that time was a time for the board to reflect. We're going to be 70 years next year, and so it was a good time for the board to reflect kind of what do they want? Were there certain things that were important to them? What's important to them? It was also a time for the staff to reflect on what's working and what's not working. So coming out of the pause, as we called it, the board, which is under new leadership, I think the biggest transition really has been with Ed's passing. Mm. And the next generation, Adam and Natasha and Jay taking the helm, really leaning into we will be a family foundation who works in Alaska and is responsive to Alaska. So we don't have a lot of private foundations have specific areas they fund. We do not. We will consider anything within Alaska. And so it was a pivotal decision even to stay the course on the board level. On the staff level, we worked really to improve and be more transparent about our responsive funding and to also simplify our applications. You mentioned in the opening how complicated it can be. And so a lot of work was done to simplify our applications, also to be more transparent to the public of how our decisions are made, what we fund. And so out of that came our Tier 1 program. A lot of people know that are what we consider small grants, but they're still significant grants under $35,000, our community support grants, and then our legacy grants. So that's the work that was done, and then we opened up last night and last month. And the first tier ones were decided on yesterday, I was just told by my team. So,
well, and drill down a little bit. As you mentioned, the current grants that are open are the tier one, $35,000 or less, the community support, which is up like $250,000 mm-hmm. or less, and legacy grants, $250,000 or more and more. What kind of projects are being funded through these various vehicles?
These are all responsive grants, so they're really up to the application in the community. So we want to know what's a priority of the community, and then we look to fund that. So those can range from everything from fixing the SPCA mobile van, so they continue the great work that they're doing on the tier one level, to the Boys and Girls Club in Kenai, you know, and helping with that building. Or recently the board in June, even though we were on pause, passed two grants. One was a $5 million grant to the university for the Arctic Leaders Initiative, where we're an early funder in that initiative, and that is really focused on how do we train Alaskans to be Arctic leaders. And the other grant was to the effort around the oral history of boarding schools. Mm-hmm. And all that. So really, we listen to community. With those three programs, we listen to community. We see what comes in from community and what's a priority for community.
And Rasmussen is, I think, a bit unusual in that you make grants for infrastructure, not just programs and support services and things like that, correct?
Yes, and so we're not just a capital funder,
sure.
But we often fund capital. We say buy, build, fix, create, but we also do programmatic funding. We're honored to be a funder of 4-Acre, and because we couldn't do our work if 4-Acre didn't do their work, so we do both programmatic funding and capital funding.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and today we're talking about Alaska's nonprofit sector. And we have in the studio today the three leaders at the helm of the largest nonprofit organizations in Alaska. Lori Wolf is the president and CEO of the 4-Acre Group. Gretchen Guess is the president and CEO of the Rasmussen Foundation. And Alex McKay is president and CEO of the Alaska Community Foundation. You can join our conversation statewide if you have questions or you want to find out how you can become involved with local nonprofits, or maybe you want to find out more about the application process. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So, Lori, coming back to you now, Alaska has a lot of nonprofits, but how do we compare to other states for just like the sheer number?
Well, that's a fun question, and sometimes a distracting question, honestly.
Sorry.
That's okay, but I'm happy to answer it. So Alaska has more nonprofits per capita than any other state in the union. It's kind of how 4-Acre gets its name, honestly. We think of the sector as Denali because it's so large, and 4-Acre is the mountain that stands next to Denali in support of, and so that's kind of how, that is the origin of our name.
Lovely.
Yeah, so we celebrate the number of nonprofits in our state because we recognize that we don't have a county system of government in Alaska, and so our nonprofits are doing the work that county governments would do in other states. And so that does mean that we're going to have more nonprofits than other places because we're doing more work than in other places. So we're the fire department in almost every community outside of our urban spaces. We're search and rescue. We are we're almost all utilities. And you know, everywhere, the big joke in our life is like, what's the first nonprofit you interacted with today? And it's just turning on your light switch, right? So we just remind our Alaskan community folks that, you know, our nonprofits are not just what you imagine when you say the word nonprofit, which is mostly health and human services. We're also all the other things as well, including public radio and all the ways that we connect across Alaska. So we do have a large number, but we're also, of course, a highly dispersed population. And so you know, we do, to echo Alex, right, communities know best about what they need. And so, yeah, that same organization could exist somewhere else in the state, but it, because it exists in a smaller community somewhere in Alaska, it's super powerful and really important. So we're not really interested too much. That's why I say it's a little distracting, because we're not too interested in having there be less. We just want the right amount to serve community, whatever that looks like in each community. So we also know it's, you know, it is an economic driver in most communities. In rural communities, we can be more than 50% of the workforce in a community. And so we understand that mostly healthcare is driving that, but, you know, also our regional Native nonprofits are doing that, which are really operating like, you know, small cities. And so, you know, again, there's a, it's more like, I think it's often a question of like, what's their impact? What's their role in community? How does the community respond to them? You know, what does that look like? I would say the other interesting thing is that only about just less than a third of our nonprofits have staff. So almost, you know, a huge amount of our organizations are operating purely on volunteer power,
yeah.
Right? And so our board members are also our, you know, envelope stuffers and our food deliverers and our, you know, like they're doing all the things, right? And so while we're a huge employment base for Alaska, we're also operating on just sheer sweat equity and human capital to just get that all those needs met across Alaska.
Well, you mentioned before we went live that there's millions of dollars in volunteer work being generated every year here.
Yeah, we do an economic study every couple of years, and we're just on the cusp of publishing that data. But I got some fun data this morning about that, and it equates to Alaskan volunteer hours equate to $9.5 million in wages if we were to pay all of those amazing people for their time. So, you know, it's an impressive moment for Alaska.
Well, and we have an email from Frankie in Juneau who says, truly a powerhouse of leadership and visionary leadership in your studio. Thanks for the show and for their work in the state. I want to say thank you to all the volunteers. Alaska runs on volunteers who benefit from an organized group. It also takes super volunteers to pull off all the projects that are supporting so many communities. If the application and reporting is simplified, it will be appreciated. So
it's
some
true.
Praise and also
yeah.
a little critique
yeah,
in there.
Yeah,
that's
for
all
sure.
Right.
Well, I don't want to miss a moment to say, you know, I think Alaskan volunteers are a little bit like Alaska voters, right? And so, you know, we have okay voter turnout, but we could have more voter turnout, right? And we could also have more volunteers. And so 4-Acre, we created something called the Alaska Board Match site so that we could match nonprofits and people who are interested in volunteering specifically on boards. And, you know, we know that there's, just as we saw a shift in the pandemic in our workforce, we're seeing that same shift in our boardrooms. And so we want to encourage more people to serve on boards and to understand what that means. And so that AK board match is a powerful tool, and it's free. And we hope that both the nonprofits are in it and the people are in it so that we can create all those matches.
And I appreciate the point that you made about, you know, turning a light switch on in the morning, you're interacting with a nonprofit. And all those volunteers that are a part of a lot of the community infrastructure, fire departments, search and rescue, yep. So many volunteers
so
that
many.
Are working for small nonprofits yep. that keep communities thriving. Lori, you monitor public policy that affects nonprofits. What are you watching for, and what are some of the big changes that have happened in recent years?
Well, we just, on October 1st, we just had a huge shift. The
yeah.
federal government, we worked for almost a decade, us and our partners at the federal level and other nonprofits across the country worked to advance some changes in the federal guidance and rules that the federal government is using around nonprofits. And so October 1 was a huge shift from the OMB about everything from the way that grants are, you can apply for them and have to report back on them, but also things like changing the audit threshold at the federal level. So it moved from $750,000 for a single state, for a federal audit, to $1 million. So that should really be very helpful for a good chunk of our nonprofits who have been having to pay tens of thousands of dollars for an audit. Now they won't have to do that because that audit threshold has changed. The other big shift that people that we're watching in that piece, that specific piece, is that right now, if you get funds from the federal government, you can get 10% for what's called operating, or what's often known as the indirect rate. That number has increased now to 15%. And it should be honored by the state of Alaska as well. Well, they might need a minute to catch up, but at the federal level, so that's more money to help keep the lights on and get the computer and pay your staff and do all the, you know, kind of the stuff that needs to happen in order for mission to happen. Mm-hmm. We call that operating cash, but sometimes it doesn't get a very good reputation out there, and there's all sorts of challenges with that. So we're pleased to see it's still not enough. 15% isn't enough. It's way better than 10. So progress.
And yeah. There's also some issues related to equity. English no longer requiring English as the only
Correct.
Language.
Yeah.
And other, as I understand it, other efforts to address simplifying the approach to how people apply. I remember 25 or so years ago, I helped a friend start a small nonprofit. The paperwork
was
unbelievable.
It's like buying a house.
So daunting. We got through it, but it was really something. So any way to simplify that seems like it would be.
Yeah, I really appreciate that the process does not have to be, they all put it out in multiple languages, which I think is so important. You know, we work really hard on the ensuring that every Alaskan is counted in the census. And one of the big barriers is language. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so having the federal government recognize that things need to be put in multiple languages to create more access it's pretty groundbreaking for them, actually. And so we're excited about that. You know, it was only October 1st that this all happened. So we're in a little bit of a wait and see mode to see kind of how it'll all kind of show up. But we're pretty optimistic. And the list is really long. If you come to 4Acres social media pages or the National Council of Nonprofits, we're kind of detailing all of the changes that are in that specific change from October 1. So we don't have time to list them all the things today, but definitely we have lots of resources that can help people know.
That sounds like some really solid progress and could really open the door for a lot of people that maybe in the past were hesitant to even try for federal grants.
I mean, I do think, again, back to the community knows best, you know, and so if you want organizations to really have the biggest impact, you know, that means that you're going to have people who speak many different languages in many different places all over our country, you know, and we need to create systems for that.
Absolutely. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. We're talking about the future of nonprofits in Alaska, and we have with us Lori Wolf, the president and CEO of the 4-Acre Group, Alex McKay, president and CEO of the Alaska Community Foundation, and Gretchen Guess, the president and CEO of the Rasmussen Foundation. We are going to take a break. We'll be back after a short break. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the important work of nonprofits in Alaska and how that work ripples out all across the state. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Leonardo is in Nenana. Hello.
Hello. Good evening. Leonardo Wassey here, Executive Director for Sanbury Tribal Associates. And hello to you all. And hi, Gretchen. You know, I really appreciate everything you guys do. One of the biggest things, hurdles we have is how do we get funding to rural Alaska? Because I know for us, it's like we're so engaged in the work that it's really hard to spend time to go through a process of applications. And I just wanted to kind of highlight the shared leadership model. You know, it works really good for nonprofit organizations and being able to expand that capacity. And, you know, we work one of our fiscal sponsors, that's the model that they use. And I just wanted to mention that, you know, one of the operating grants we have is it's about recognizing the work and seeing the work we do. And because we participate with them on a lot of activities in food security and food justice across the country. But that being said, it's, you know, the active participation, it allows us to, you know, not have to necessarily go through a long, lengthy process. And we're able to, you know, kind of demonstrate, you know, the work through, you know, a written report or, you know, by the people that we're interacting with. So I just wanted to, you know, say there are different ways of getting, you know, grant funding to organizations that, you know, are really, you know, doing amazing work out, you know, bringing indigenous perspectives to a lot of, you know, policy, you know, and those attention to, you know, community and food security. And so,
yeah. Well, Leonardo, thank you for laying out what are, you know, some really important points about the needs in rural Alaska. I saw all three of our president CEOs here nodding their heads in agreement. So do you want to weigh in here on some of what Leonardo's talking about?
I think we all do.
I know. I was like, I think we all want to weigh in.
Gretchen, start us off.
Sure. I'll talk to you about some of the pivots Rasmussen's making in this effort. And, you know, we're one of many people who get to invest and walk alongside community. Very similar to the federal government, right? We're recognizing within our application process there's a transactional cost, right, of doing grant making. And so those indirect costs, those operating costs, covering more of those. We are trying to be more accessible. You can go online now to our website, and you actually can book time with a PO online. Mm-hmm. And just talk about, you have an idea and want to know about funding. So trying to lean in, you've always been able to call the foundation and talk with someone. And it's always one of those tenets that both Elmer and Ed wanted, was that people would pick up the phone. And our board staffs us to be very high touch. It's very unusual in the foundation space. So I think part of funding rural Alaska and underrepresented communities is just really leaning into the accessibility, the language, being out in community, making it easy for people to contact you. And so we're really leaning into that space at Rasmussen. I'm really happy to announce we're a sponsor of AFN this year. We're going to have a booth at AFN so people can learn. What I'm trying to get across to me and my team is, let's not assume everyone knows about us and what funding we do, because there are plenty of people who don't. So I think it's for us as an investor in the state, it really is more external outreach. And with that then comes new areas that we haven't funded, new leaders that we haven't funded and that we want to fund. So I'll hand it over to the other powerful women.
Yes, Alex, please weigh in here.
Yeah, no, I love the question. So at the Community Foundation, really our purpose, and we all have a slightly different mission, is to grow and support philanthropy statewide. And so the way we do that is, you know, we want to connect, you know, people who care is what we say, with causes that matter. And the way that we know what matters is by engaging with local community members. One of the primary ways we do that is through our affiliate program. So we have affiliates in, and they're really community funds in 11 communities. And then we have partners in other places in the state. And all of the money that's raised in those community funds, in those communities, stay in that community. We have a staff person part-time in those communities. Mm. And then the advisory group that makes the decisions are from those communities, and they make the decisions. So back to your point, we don't make the decisions. We create the process. And philanthropy exists everywhere, you know. So, you know, this is an ancient land, and we're just a very young state, and we're in the business of the philanthropy. So we're creating these kind of business models or vehicles. But the work really takes place in local communities. One example is, you know, one of the things that we've done is disaster relief. So that's come up very suddenly. Yeah, yeah, Western Alaska Relief Fund with Typhoon Mirbeck, and that was incredible. You know, it all happened. It was actually my predecessor, Nina Kempel, who ran that. But so many people contributed. You know, there were people from out of the state, so many individuals. But we didn't make the decisions. We partnered with CoWERIC. CoWERIC has a fund with us. So all of the money went into that fund. And then CoWERIC helped distribute the money in partnership with Calista and others in the
they're
area.
They're right there on the ground.
Yep, they're on the ground. And they created the process. And I recently was there talking to Melanie Banky and her team, and it was interesting. It's a process we would never come up with and we would never know about. But what they did is they realized that Gullivan was the hardest hit, and so they wanted to address that quickly. There had already been a determination of which homes had been destroyed, which ones had been damaged, and then fish camps, which are critical. It was the fall, so basically a year's worth of subsistence food and food security became an issue. They quickly created a process for, if you own one of those homes, you get this amount of money. If you have a home that was damaged, you get a different amount. If it's a fish camp, it's a different amount. And so that's not really an application, complicated application process. It's sort of like, yes, this is my home. This is who I am. And we heard from a woman that worked there about how meaningful that was. There was no red tape. There was no delay. It was money immediately. And she was talking about the emotional impact of losing the fish camp that was her grandfather's and her brother's and had helped to build, and they had just remodeled, and it was completely destroyed. They didn't have to account for what was the value and fill out lots of FEMA forms, not asked, do you want to do a loan or do you want to just go for this? There were no questions asked. It was just a check. So that was the value of the decision-making locally.
And we also saw that some changes at FEMA as far as reimbursements for things like the equipment that you need to go out and hunt and gather and fish, because that is someone's livelihood. So there has been some progress on that front as well. And Alex, as I mentioned earlier, I am the chair of a small advisory board, advisory fund at ACF. We make grants to newsrooms and journalists. But I think it's important for folks to know that you don't have to be a 501c3. You don't have to go through all that process of creating a nonprofit, waiting for federal approval. You can be a fund. And that kind of ties into a question that we had by email here. Dennis writes, Juno has a community foundation too. Please talk about directed donor funds for community foundations. He says, I will be establishing a personal one soon. We'll be putting money there for a scholarship at UAS. He says, but I don't want UAS to have control of it. So talk about, I don't know why, he doesn't clarify, but please talk about those donor funds and the distinction there with not having to be a formal 501c3.
A couple of things. So first of all, Amy Skillbred, who runs Juno Community Foundation, that actually started as an affiliate program. So they were not a 501c3. And then they matured and, graduated, and they're free, and they are a 501c3, a very successful one. And so there are donor-advised funds created, and what that does is it really kind of protects the money. Sometimes it's an endowment, sometimes it's for certain purposes. And so in this case, if you want to do a donor-advised fund in Juno, you can say it's for UAS, and you can create who are the decision-makers. You can decide, make a recommendation anyway, which is generally accepted unless it's something outlandish. So you'd pick the advisors, you'd let them know, and that's what what Juno Community Foundation would honor. It sounds negative when, the donor says, I don't want the organization itself to control it, but in some ways it's sort of a protection. Sometimes organizations go through ebbs and flows, and so there's money that's sort of protected from that decision making. And so it really gives more accountability by having different advisors.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. We are going to go back to the phones for a moment. Stu is here in Anchorage. Hello. Stu is probably still in Anchorage, but no longer on the phone. So, Lori, you mentioned this a little bit earlier, the disruption to the economy, the extreme disruption that the pandemic caused. Nonprofits, like every other business entity, were greatly affected. How well have they been able to recover? You mentioned the problem that so many organizations are having with staffing and volunteers. Mm-hmm. Is that getting better?
not particularly getting better yet, but we're hopeful. I like to say in the pandemic really had kind of two kind of very different kinds of impact on the nonprofit sector. In one case, we're talking about health and human service organizations, which had to triple overnight in their delivery of service while simultaneously losing all of their in-person volunteers and losing funding to some degree, although the funding did come back very strongly, but it took a minute. So we had that, right, like this huge need for more services, right, everything from food insecurity issues, housing, like all the things, right, that make our human life possible. And then on the other end of the spectrum was like our arts and culture organizations, which literally had to close their doors in the name of public health. And they had to keep their staff and keep their missions going and, if you will, feed the animals if you were the Sea Life Center or the zoo, but there was no people, which meant that there was no income, which meant that there was, right? And so we wanted all, you know, I kept saying in these groups, like, we want to come out of this pandemic and still have art and culture and celebration and experience, and we need that. So we have to figure out how we make sure that when we come out of this, we have both. And so the relief funding was, it was the first time in America's history that that nonprofits were included in federal relief funding. That was no small effort. We had a small role to play, and so did all of our sister organizations across the country. And no small effort, as Alex mentioned, to get the state of Alaska to also recognize nonprofits in that. We worked really hard about that. And so, you know, that, and then there was in the end, there was a wonderful set of funding called Save Our Stages funding, which really did actually support the arts and culture organizations in Alaska in a very significant way. And so when we talk about recovery coming out of the pandemic, we do see our arts and culture organizations, they're okay. They're all still here. We didn't lose any of them.
Yay.
I know, yay. I feel really grateful for that. Both the really small ones and the big ones, right? And we didn't lose any of them, at least that we know of. So we feel grateful for that. And the other organizations, I think, are, you know, now kind of right-sizing. You know, the needs haven't gone away, right? We still have major food insecurity issues. We have a child care crisis in Alaska. We have a housing crisis in Alaska. So those needs haven't shifted, but organizations are right-sizing their staff and their money and their people. But the people are still a problem. We have a workforce shortage in Alaska overall. All the data, I'm sure you've had lots of shows about that. I don't have to repeat it to you. But when you talk about that the nonprofit sector is, you know, overall 10% of the workforce or 50% of the workforce in rural communities, we aren't immune from that, right? And so in some cases, those are life or death decisions that we don't have enough people in our workplaces.
You know, I think it's extraordinary that, as you noted, none of the nonprofits went under. And I think it's safe to assume that many nonprofits don't have deep reserves, that they're operating on shoestring budgets
Absolutely. And
barely covering things. And so it's pretty extraordinary that they were all able to stay whole.
I mean, I think it's really a testament to the power of volunteers as well as the power of the staff, right? I mean, resiliency, Alaskans are resilient. Yeah. And just the sheer will to make it work. But I often say, like, we were all shaken like a snow globe in the pandemic, and our business models were upside down and sideways and all the ways. And, you know, to an organization that I talk to, it would be shocking to find one that is like, oh, yeah, everything's great.
Yeah.
Because everyone is trying to figure it out, right?
All right, we are going to take another short break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about nonprofits in Alaska and the way forward as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Hello, we're back. All right, today we are talking about Alaska nonprofits with three powerful leaders in the nonprofit world here in Alaska. We have in the studio Lori Wolf, the president and CEO of the 4-Acre Group, Alex McKay, president and CEO of the Alaska Community Foundation, and Gretchen Guess, the president and CEO of the Rasmussen Foundation. Alex, you have a lot of scholarship funds. I'm trying to find my question here, and I'm not locating it, but I think you have more than like 50 scholarship
Over
funds,
50,
is that right?
Correct.
Can you talk a little bit about how that works and what people can be thinking about if they're seeking scholarship funding?
Well, it works a lot more efficiently than it did. So each one, Alaska Community Foundation went through a big growth period, and so really took in lots of different, had lots of different vehicles. I call it kind of a bespoke model, and really custom designed a lot of the scholarship programs. I know when my son tried to apply a couple of years ago, you had to find, you know, where, you know, when is the deadline, all different applications, and it's actually been unified. And so this past year is unified, and so it's one application, one date, and then the awards are made. But the awards are made by different types of committees. Mm. And so there is still a variety. And out of the, we sort of budget or hope for between $12 and $15 million a year of grant making, and a million of it, you know, was awarded this year in scholarship funds.
Oh, that's outstanding. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. So helpful to young people seeking education. Lori, talk about the distinctions between earned and charitable funding support.
I do want to just quickly say that all of our Native Education Foundations also do scholarships, and they're some of our largest private foundations in Alaska. And so there's also that that moment for folks that I don't want to miss. So nonprofits, I think the difference between the charitable money, that's mission-related earned revenue versus charitable contributions from people, corporations, and foundations. I think one of the myths, right, is that all of nonprofits all run on charitable giving, but a good chunk of our nonprofits, again, because they're operating more like county governments and doing direct services, there is a fee-for-service relationship there. There's an earned income relationship there. And I do think that, you know, deserves more conversation than we probably have time for today. But it is a myth-busting moment, right? Nonprofits do rely on charitable contributions, and that money is so important and essential to the work of missions. And kind of, I always talk about it like the Holy Grail. There's kind of never enough of it, and we're always looking for it. And lots of our organizations have an earned income component to their work.
All right. Gretchen, turning back to you, Rasmussen Foundation funds nonprofits, but also other organizations. Mm-hmm. Talk about how that works and how you're making awards to other entities that aren't nonprofits.
Yes, and I'm going to tag on to what Lori said,
sure,
because I just want to emphasize this concept of what our nonprofits do. And how I think about it is, like, nonprofits are businesses too, and I think we often forget that. They are the people providing services, and just like GCI expects to get paid, we need to pay our nonprofits. And so this is just a shout out to those in the government sector. Just because they're a nonprofit doesn't mean they shouldn't get paid and paid timely. And I know that's coming up, but that's a passion of mine, just to remind folks of what nonprofits do and how they should be treated in our community.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? Through all of that, I totally forgot your question.
But we appreciate that, Gretchen. That's very helpful for us. That is our number one public policy priority right there.
Yeah. And the question was making grants to the other entities that are not nonprofits. How does that work?
Yeah. We go by federal law. So there's certain things we can do, and there's certain things we can't do. We can fund nonprofits. We can fund tribes, we can fund organizations, we can fund cities. We have actually a breadth of, it's more, there's only a very short list of what we can't fund. And so that looks like all of the other applications and the other things we do. Most of our funding goes to government entities, nonprofits, and tribes. And because those are the people, honestly, on the ground doing the work.
Doing the work every day in their communities. All right, let's go back to the phones quickly. Nicole is in Petersburg. Hello, Nicole.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. And thank you to the Power Trio for the work that you do and the leadership that you share throughout Alaska. I am concerned about the well-being and the resiliency of our nonprofit leaders, our board members, our staff members, the people in our communities who really move and shake. And as you noted earlier in the conversation, some of that work to keep these entities alive, especially through COVID and just the political realities of that time, have really taken a toll on those folks. What kinds of suggestions or ideas or thoughts do you have to recuperate and rebuild some of that resilience that's necessary to do the work in the nonprofit world?
Thank you for the question, Nicole. I'm seeing all three leaders here nodding sagely along because they understand this. And it kind of gets at also, for so long, the thinking was, well, it's a calling when you go to work for a nonprofit, so you should go to work for hardly any money. And, you know, you can't attract the best
the
brightest
leaders.
That's
myth-making, right?
If you,
mm-hmm.
Yes,
yeah.
If you're not respecting people's knowledge.
That's right.
So, In service to that idea of resiliency and paying people what they're worth, what are you all thinking about in that regard?
Gosh, yes, please.
Lori,
please. I would like all of our nonprofit people to make a livable wage and have access to health care. And yes, please, right? And so we do publish data, salary and benefit data, that can help people know the right answers, mm-hmm. Or the better answers at least, and then work a plan to get to those answers if they can't get to them overnight. You know, I do also have to say, right, part of it is, a lot of it is money, and there's also this, we have a saying at 4-Acre, right, unsupported leaders go extinct, right? So our leaders need support, and they need to be listened to and heard, and we need to create community around them, and we can't just keep asking and asking and asking for them to do more and more and more work. So we have to create mechanisms of support, and that's what 4-Acre is all about, and I hope those, I've been to Petersburg many times to support the amazing nonprofits in that community, and I hope we can have a deeper conversation about what that looks like in these particular examples. But I also want to say, like, there's we also do reports about the gender pay gap in the sector and in Alaska overall, mm-hmm. right? So there's also that dynamic going on, right? But I would be remiss if to say, you know, if it was just that easy, we'd all be doing it. And the problem is often is the revenue model of our nonprofits, right? We want our nonprofit leaders to be paid a living wage and have access to healthcare and all the things. But our revenue doesn't keep up with that conversation. The federal grant conversations are years in the making, mm-hmm. and they don't just turn on a dime. And the if inflation changes, we don't get to go back to our amazing funders and say, oh, by the way, could you also just increase our funding? Could you increase our funding this year because of inflation? Like, that's not the way those funding models work. So we can't, like, the state doesn't shift with inflation. There's the federal government doesn't shift with inflation. Our private foundations don't shift with inflation. So we're caught in a place where we can't raise enough money either through charitable contributions or earned revenue to actually keep up in the marketplace. So that is also one of the reasons that we have a workforce shortage, because you could work at Starbucks for more money than you could work at a lot of our nonprofits. And
ouch.
That's not good.
Yeah, that's
right?
Not good.
No,
absolutely.
That's not good.
So we only have a couple minutes left, and I want to get to a question of the present consideration. Another hurricane is hammering Florida right now. They haven't even started recovery from the last horrible hurricane event, and here comes another one. And other climate change effects are increasing everywhere, as we all know. How are you all thinking about how community needs may change and intensify, and what nonprofits will need to do to respond to the, you know, as we know, climate change is happening in the Arctic much faster than other places in the world. Alex, at the Community Foundation, what are the conversations about this?
We have been talking about this a lot, actually. My VP of Programs and Grants, Megan, has been looking at how we've actually addressed disaster relief. Often it's at the last minute. You know, it's in the moment, whether it was the earthquake, whether it was there was an Alaska Can-Do where individuals could fund people during the COVID issue. There was a slide in Ketchikan. You know, there are the floods in Juneau. And what we're looking at is talking to our partners and different people about establishing a fund, a disaster fund that's in place, and to actually talk about what will the governance look like so that you're ready to go. You know, hundreds of people will contribute, you know, and we can open it up in just a matter of days. But it's good if you've made those decisions ahead of time. You know, look at who is it do you need to partner with? When is it the Red Cross gets involved, or when is it, and start looking at some of that. There was some money left over from the Western Alaska Disaster Fund, and there was actually a partnership with the Alaska Municipal League in Chulista to build out some things, tools that they could have used, kind of some mapping and different things that will help them when this happens again. And so those are the kinds of things we're thinking about and that we're going to look at next
year.
That
sounds outstanding and right on track with what's needed. Gretchen, in just less than a minute here, if you could comment on the thinking at Rasmussen about these things.
Sure. I would say, and also we have Project 80s. Those of us that remember Project 80s, which was when we had a whole bunch of funding in the state and we built a whole bunch of things, well, it was a while ago. So in addition to all of this, we have really old buildings, and we have a lot of really old buildings and old infrastructure within the state that hasn't been kept up. So what we're thinking about is we're a funder in these areas. So if there's a need, please apply to funding for us, because we will fund a lot of that work that's around resiliency.
All right. Thank you so much to our guest today, Lori Wolf, President and CEO of the 4-Acre Group, Gretchen Guest, the President and CEO of the Rasmussen Foundation, and Alex McKay, President and CEO of the Alaska Community Foundation. Thanks to our engineer, Chris Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose, and Ava White helped out on the phones today. And thank you for listening. I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.